still keep on marching off to war. Electrically they keep a baseball score. And the beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-da-da-da-dee. La-da-da-da-da.
Grandma's sitting chairs and reminisce.
Boys keep chasing girls to get a kiss.
The cars keep a going faster all the time.
Mom still cries, hey buddy, have you got a dime?
And the beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain.
Sookrum's Brewing Company and UMFM 101.5 present Sunday Sessional, a monthly pairing of UMFM program hosts and musical guests in the intimate environs of Sookrum's Tap Room. Spend a Sunday afternoon enjoying song selections from one of your favorite radio hosts and stripped-down performances from some of the city's best artists while enjoying a tasty beverage or two. This free event happens monthly at Sookrum's Tap Room, located at 479B Warsaw Avenue. But like a rotating tap, each one is unique with a new host and slate of performers. For more information on Sunday sessional dates and details, visit the event calendar at umfm.com and come join us at Sookrum's.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is Jeff Lowe, highly accomplished British sculptor who came to prominence in the 1970s, experimenting with various materials and innovatively advancing abstract sculpture in small and large scale works, jewelry, and silkscreen prints. Jeff attended St. Martin's School of Art in London and Leicester College of Art in the UK, and was taught by such master sculptors as Sir Anthony Carroll, Philip King, and William Tucker. Early in his career, he had a one-man show at the renowned Leicester Gallery in London, then represented Britain in the Paris Biennale, on the Sainsbury Award and the Paulette Krasner Award, and was a resident artist in colleges in Australia and Yugoslavia. Jeff has taught classes at Reading University, Canterbury College of Art, and Central St. Martin's. He has exhibited in numerous national and international solo and group exhibitions, including the Hayward and Serpentine Galleries in London, the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice, Centre for Contemporary Art in Melbourne, Australia, galleries in Portugal, Holland, US and Canada. His works may be found in numerous prominent collections such as the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge in the UK, the Arts Council of Great Britain, and the National Gallery of Australia. In 2020, Jeff's works were shown in the brilliant exhibition In the Close Distance at the Pangolin Gallery in London, and more recently at the Lindenhall Studio UK in a show entitled Rock, Paper, Scissors. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
You've been sculpting since the age of 15 with a passionate devotion to your art, experimenting with various materials, innovative techniques, and building on your artistic experiences. Can you tell us about your early years and some of your discoveries over that time?
Well, I probably got into making sculpture almost by accident at about the age of 15. I made a sculpture for a GCSE examination at school. I was put into this class for sculpture, and I had to make a portrait head and a figurative group. And so I loved the actual process of making, but I actually liked as well casting these pieces, so made in clay and then casting them into plaster. I found that process really fascinating and exciting. So I've always liked making things right from a young age. And I think that I was more interested in making than I was in drawing or painting. It was always for me, I always had to figure things out through making. I can't often imagine what it is or see what it is that I'm going to do without actually making it. So from the first point at the age of 15, from making sculpture, I never wanted to do anything else. It was just completely took me over. And at the age of 17, I got accepted to go to Leicester College of Art. And I was very lucky because at Leicester College of Art, there were mainly sculptors. By chance, there were just lots of sculptors working there. And initially, when I went there, this was a foundation course. And I was expected or asked to do other courses, which included fashion and textiles, graphic design, illustration, things like this. And I just said, no, I'm not doing it. I'm only making sculpture because I know exactly what I want to do. My head of department initially said, well, you won't get into a college if you don't. And I said, well, fine, but I'm not doing it. I'm not doing anything else. And then finally, after having made lots and lots of sculptures, he basically put his arm around me and said, you can do whatever you want. And towards the end of that year, I was visited because my work had become quite known. Leicester's probably about an hour and a half from London. And Anthony Caro and Bill Tucker came to see my work at Leicester and said, basically, you've got to come to St. Martin's. The idea of going to London didn't really appeal to me that much. I think I was a little nervous about it. But then I decided, okay, they've told me that's where I should be, so that's where I went. And obviously that was the place where, during the 1960s, from the early 60s, right the way through, became absolutely dominant base for making sculpture and innovative and experimental sculpture from then on. Not just actual made sculpture, but conceptual work and other forms of art.
You did a couple of residencies in Australia and Yugoslavia. How did that contribute to some of your early working practice and going forward? And would you recommend those types of experiences?
So often, I have a house and studio in Portugal as well. So in the summer months, I would go there and I would send materials over there for a project. Rather than trying to do the same sort of work that I would do in England or in London, I would send things over there. And because it might only be for 2 weeks or a month or something like that, I would specifically try to do things there that I wouldn't do here. So that idea of actually going somewhere in the world and making things, I find really interesting. And I like the idea that I can work with a limited range of equipment, materials. I quite enjoy if someone said to me, a little bit like being on a cooking program where they give you, you know, 4 ingredients and you have to come up with a meal. I like that idea of someone, even myself, thinking, okay, I'll work with cardboard and a bit of plaster and some wire. Or it's interesting for me to actually be given a challenge which is outside of my normal thinking. But when I first went to St. Martin's, it wasn't what I expected because we were part of a course which was called the locked room, where we were locked into a room and we weren't allowed to speak for 6 months. I was expecting to go to St. Martin's and continue making sculpture and be taught by people who I admired enormously. But we were locked in this room and I did that for a year. And then at the end of that year, we were given the option to either make sculpture or become more involved in a more conceptual approach to sculpture, which I decided was not for me. I wanted to make things. So in a way, I had a year which I wouldn't say it was wasted, but it wasn't what I expected. So in a way, these invitations to go places, I wish I did it more because I love it. If there's anyone listening who wants to invite me, I love it. So it's great. And I would recommend it to anybody, particularly there are quite a lot of these things when students finish to go and do a residency somewhere. It's a great thing to do. It gives you studio space, a certain amount of money. In the case of Australia, when I went there, they wanted me to go there for a year. And I thought, I can't go for a year. And then I think I went for 2 or 3 months. And then I thought, after the 2 or 3 months, I thought, gosh, I wish I'd stayed on a bit longer. I really enjoyed it. And I made a lot of sculptures there. And I think that kind of pressure, you know, to do something in a shorter period of time, to try and make something, and even if it's working in a more experimental way, I think it's very good. Anthony Caro started a workshop called Triangle Artist Workshop in upstate New York. And that went on for many, many years. And I went with Tony to Russia to try and set up workshops in Moscow. And we couldn't get it going properly because this was quite a few years ago and the mafia were still very strongly influencing the situation. And we tried to explain that this was a charitable venture, but we kept getting hounded by people that thought that there was money to be made and that they could interfere. And in the end, Tony didn't like it very much. So although I went there three times and we found a great place, not in Moscow, but in St. Petersburg, we found this amazing old monastery where we would set this up. It just didn't happen. But they're good things, and there are lots of them around.
In early 2020, you had a new series of brilliant dynamic sculptures and silkscreen prints that were shown in London in the exhibition entitled In the Close Distance. Can you describe a few of those pieces in the series and take us through the process for how you designed and built these sculptures?
About 5 years ago, I moved from London to Kent to a building which is called the Lime Works, which was built in 1937 as an industrial building for purifying water. So it consists of two enormous funnels and an Art Deco tower in between the two funnels, and alongside it, a big industrial workshop. Some people had tried, they'd spent about 10 or 12 years putting in concrete floors, staircases, and trying to sort the place out. In the end, it got the better of them in the sense that it just cost way more than they ever imagined. And they basically, the bank repossessed it and it came up for sale. And the price just kept coming down. Every 6 months, it would be a lot less, a lot less, a lot less. Because mainly people couldn't take on the challenge. It looked too big. And anyway, my wife said, this is a sculptor's house. You should have it. You should live there. After thinking about it long and hard, we decided to buy it. And it basically transformed my life and my way of making. I'd been in London since I was 18. And so moving to a more countryside location where we have about 12 acres of land and a building which is almost like a piece of sculpture in the sense that when you're internally, you can see through from one room to another. And there's a lot of glass, a lot of levels. It's very high. You can see from about a height of about 40 feet above me where I'm sitting right now into different areas and different levels. So it's an incredibly inspiring building. And when I moved here, I didn't work for a little while because we were trying to sort the house out and I had lots of builders working here. And when I started making sculptures again, I decided to work, firstly, I wanted to work in aluminium. I wanted to work with laser cut sheets of material so that I would draw on a computer, make drawings of openings and shapes and curvilinear sheets. And I started working with a rolling machine to curve these pieces and put them together. Most sculptures that you see are either volumetric in the sense that they're maybe a carved block, or often if it's sort of welded sculpture, then it's gestural and linear and taking up space. I think what I wanted to do was to make a sculpture that had many layers so that you could see through from the outside through windows or openings. And I wanted the sort of top of the sculpture to have a almost landscape-like curves around the sculpture. I also, most of the sculptures I'd made up to that point had been formed with, really, they'd had a front, a back, and sides. They were still very three-dimensional. You walked around them. But what I found interesting about these circular sculptures was that they really made the person looking at it move around and around and around. And there wasn't really one particular point which the sculpture made sense, with very, very much a sort of experience of seeing the sculpture in the round. And they started off on a relatively small scale, and then they started getting bigger. Oh, and at the same point, I decided it had been very difficult with Tony Caro having used color so much. It's almost as if someone, it's a silly thing to think, but it's almost as if someone owns that. It's not the first time someone's used color, but in sculpture, you think, well, can I do that? Because it's a little bit like taking from somebody else. Anyway, I decided, because these particular sculptures needed a code, if you like, so that the outer layer would be different from an inner layer, and you'd get this sense of the depth and the space between things. After having made quite a few of these sculptures, I'd never made silkscreen prints. I'd only ever made woodblock prints, which I'd made in my own studio. I'd never gone to a printmaking studio or work with anyone in a more professional sense. And these sculptures seemed to suggest silkscreen, because I knew that silkscreen was about putting on layers, one layer upon another layer upon another layer. And I just decided that I wanted to make in two dimensions an equivalent of my three-dimensional sculpture. So I'd known about this guy called Kip Gresham at the Cambridge Print Studio for many years. He'd worked with so many artists, Terry Frost, John Hoyland, Barry Flanagan, lots and lots of sculptors and painters. So he was my obvious choice. I thought, well, if I'm going to work with anyone, I'll go and work with him. So I turned up for a day just to get an idea of what I might do. And he was very helpful. And I went away and then started to prepare drawings for various screens. I didn't want to know what I was doing. I didn't want to know. Some people will go and make a silk screen and it will be, they'll go there with a drawing or a watercolor and say, I want to make that. I didn't want that. I wanted to make the prints as I make the sculpture, which is very intuitively and very much reacting to what's in front of my eyes. So I would make, in the early stages, probably six screens. And up till now, we're making 12, 15 screens to work from. Some of them have got more than one image on. So we have a huge choice of images. But I don't really plan where they're going to be. They change. I've now been 12 visits to the print studio for 3 days each visit. And each time I go, I tackle a different kind of area or problem. But every time I go, I want to learn things. I don't want to know what I'm doing. I want at the end of the day, each day, to actually think, wow, I didn't expect that. So the sculpture and the prints had this incredible connection. And at the same time, I started making small sculptures in brass. And I found that really useful too. Some of them were the starting point for bigger sculptures. Some of them were just things in their own right. I don't really make maquettes for things, usually. I tend to work on the piece directly. So they've changed and developed over the print studio. I've been working for about 2.5, 3 years there. And on these particular aluminium sculptures, probably around 3.5 to 4 years that I've been working on them. I've never seen the prints together. In other words, the whole 12 episodes. And so what was fantastic was we put 50 prints in the gallery from the first earliest pieces right through till pieces that were made at my last visit. And so for me, that was really interesting because I could see the story develop and really have a very good look at them, because each time I go there in 3 days, I work with monotypes. I've made some edition prints, but I prefer to work with unique monoprints. So I often make about 30 to 40 prints in 3 days. And it's a fantastic process because it gives you the chance to try out lots of different possibilities. When you're making a sculpture, there are points at which you think, if I'd actually done something differently, it would have gone off on a completely different tangent. The thing with the prints is that you can almost see, you can include all of the different directions because they each have a different starting point. The screen might start at the front on the paper first in one print. It might be the last thing you put in another print, which gives you all these different complexities. Oh, and then the color is extraordinary because that's very hard to predict what will happen. So I love that unexpected quality in the same way that I do in the sculpture. I don't want to make something that I understand. I want to make something that has a kind of magic that makes me think about it, that it's puzzling as a thing, that it keeps me wondering about it, and hopefully everybody else. That's really how I work. And then when I was making the big aluminium sculptures, in order to be able to give them some flexibility of working, we were just working with nuts and bolts rather than welding. My work traditionally has been welded, but we basically decided, okay, we'll bolt them whilst we're working. But the bolts then became part of the process. It enabled me then to take them apart, paint them, put them back together. And if I want to change the color, it's very easy. Take them apart, try another color. So it's a very flexible process.
Some of the titles of your sculptures refer to music. How has music played a role in your work?
Well, as soon as I go in the studio, the music goes on. I can't work without music. Some artists hate it. They have to work in total quiet. But for me, making sculpture is quite a physical, noisy process. There's stuff happening, and particularly if I'm working with assistants. So I like the music, and I couldn't listen to a program where someone's talking about the subject because then I'd have to tune in. But I can listen to music, and what I tend to do is I get obsessed with a particular piece of music, and it will be played over and over and over and over again, which drives my assistants completely crazy. But I find that if I play the piece over and over again, it has a kind of association with the work. And I find if I change the music, it's something about the mood changes. So I tend to play the same music as I'm working on one thing. And I've nearly always, certainly for the last 12 to 15 years, I've always done that. And the music changes, but it's often classical music. I love Philip Glass. The series of sculptures that were shown at Pangolin refer to Handel, mainly arias from Handel operas. So I'll literally play Handel for months, and I'll just go through every opera, every piece of music, and I just get completely obsessed. And then it might be Philip Glass, and I'll play this over and over again. And then I'll find things, I'll hear things that I don't know about, bits of music that are new to me. And I love actually buying CDs. I'll download some music and I will go on Spotify to find things, but I actually have to have the CD. And I love looking along the shelves and picking the CD up, putting them on. It seems to be part of the process of choosing. And I must say, I remember going to Tony Caro's studio for the first time when I was probably 18. He had a big studio in Camden Town. When I walked in, there were sculptures everywhere and speakers in the ceiling, and he was playing chamber music. I just thought, this is what I want to do. This is what I want. I want that. Because it just seemed like total bliss to be in a workshop. And I guess I've always worked on lots of sculptures as well at the same time. So I'm usually working on sometimes 5 or 6 pieces at one time. So I like that, of having them around. Once they're finished, I don't want them around. I like to get them out. And then I start new pieces, which they're often related to the other pieces, but there's something about the influence that a thing can have on you if it's in the same space. So I prefer to start afresh without them being around. And the change here in the Limeworks is that I always describe my studios in London were always warehouse buildings without really outside space, or not much. There might be a courtyard or something like that. There wasn't really outside space. So most of the sculptures that I made were made indoors, shown in galleries, very rarely shown outside. And since I've been here, we've been developing the landscape and putting sculptures more and more into the landscape. And I've built, well, I say I've built, my builders have built this incredible series of platforms, which I call the outdoor gallery. So it's in the landscape, but it's concrete surfaces on different levels with steps moving from one to another. And what it enables me to do is to see sculptures in relation to each other. And sometimes when sculptures are just placed in the landscape, which I don't mind, and we're doing that as well, but I love that idea that there's a relationship between the sculptures. So you stand on the different levels, you see sculptures at different heights, you look down and see the sculptures, and then there's a relationship between them, as you would see in a gallery space, an inside gallery space. So I'm enjoying that, which is something that would not have been possible in London.
And do you plan to do some site-specific works in any of the sculpture parks?
I'm much more interested now in working outside. So the last two very large sculptures on show, which opened on Tuesday in a space in London. And I wanted specifically to see two pieces, went almost like the other way around. I made them outside and I wanted to see how they'd look in a more confined space because they're huge pieces. And then from there, they'll go up to a sculpture park in Yorkshire in end of March, and they'll be shown there for a year. It's very close to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, and it's called Thirsk Hall Sculpture Park. It's a new place. Thirsk Hall is a huge country house with land, and they've now been restoring a very large barn, which my small sculptures and prints, there'll be, again, maybe 50 or 60 prints, quite a few of them which weren't shown at the exhibition that finished last week, and they'll all be shown in the barn, and then 7 big sculptures outside. They've been building it up for about 2 years. And I think this year, now that they've got the indoor space as well, it'll start to develop. So they're very good. And the person that's organizing it has been involved in sculpture for a very long time, but mainly in London, in galleries in London. He's 35, so he's very young to be doing it, but he's a great guy, very in love with sculpture. What I have here, for example, at Limeworks, is a kind of changing space. So seven of the sculptures that are outside at the moment will go off to Thirsk. And what I like is the idea that these platforms that I've created and bases that I've created around the space, they will just be occupied by other new sculptures and some old sculptures which I have in storage. So it will be constantly changing. I don't want it to stay stagnant. I like the idea that the sculptures are going off somewhere else for a period of time, and then I'm making new sculptures and they're going outside. One of the great things about outdoor space is that a lot of the sculptures that I made over the years they're in storage, and it's a great shame because even I haven't seen some of them for 10 years. And they're just sitting in containers and in storage spaces and things like that. So it's better to get them out and put them somewhere.
Now, there's certainly a lot of sculpture parks.
I think one of the problems with sculpture and students making sculpture often nowadays, because I stopped teaching quite a long time, but I come in contact with a lot of students. It's very hard to make sculpture. And a lot of the colleges where people are taught in to make sculpture, it's not conducive to making because there are so many issues relating to health and safety, workshop spaces that you can only book in for an hour or 2 hours a day. You have to take your thing up there to make it. And my background was making sculpture in the space. And very much now, a lot of the students are making almost sculpture, designing sculpture. And then if they have an exhibition, they'll make something for an exhibition. For me, I find that slightly disappointing in the sense that I think that sculpture, being an artist, is a day-to-day thing. It doesn't matter whether you show it somewhere or not. You have to make it. You have to keep on making it, and you have to have materials all around you. You have to be inspired by that stuff. And in a way, it's almost the things that come about by accident or by looking and seeing things that are unexpected that develop sculpture. It's not always or often the things that we know about. You know, so ideas can be very limited. I mean, you can think you've got a great idea, but visually, it might be incredibly limited. And for me, I think that it's a shame that art schools generally, except I went and taught a few years ago at the New York Studio School, which was very much like an old style art school. I found it very exciting because I like working with the students as a part teacher, part assistant, helping them, showing them things, and actually seeing things happen and making them work to a pace that's each day might be making three or four things in different materials. And they get very excited. And sculpture is difficult because at first it can seem quite daunting until you know at least the basics. Some people don't know how to screw a piece of wood together or, you know, mix a bowl of plaster or whatever it might be. Once you get over that initial point, it becomes really exciting. But often the computer can seem a much easier option or an option that colleges are pushing students towards. And I think it's a great shame. And it applies to everything. It applies to architecture. It's sometimes making models, doing drawings by hand, things like that, where the imagination develops is really important.
You had done an exhibition in Canada a while back. Can you tell us a little about that one?
It was an exhibition organized by the British Council and the Canada Council. At that time, I was making sculptures in stone and steel. So linear elements in steel and blocks of stone, which I bought from quarries, and I'd buy maybe 20 or 30 tons of stone in one load, and then I'd have lots of steel, which generally would be curved. The sculptures were quite different. This was probably around 77, 76. And I made a lot of these sculptures, and they were shown at the Serpentine Gallery. And then the British Council picked up on those, and they put on a show of some artists from Canada and some from England. And they then traveled for 2 years, I think about a year traveling all over Canada and then a year traveling all over England to different museums and galleries. That was my visit to Edmonton in Alberta. Being the artists there, they all had amazing studios. The big, I mean, London was a bit like that in the early 70s, you know, there were so many buildings in Docklands area, industrial buildings that developers didn't know what to do with. And probably they were thinking of knocking them down. And the artists just moved into these huge spaces and then lived in them illegally. And then that whole concept of live work. And it's interesting because I heard a Canadian guy at a talk who talked specifically, because I think it's quite a big thing in Canada, live work in warehouses. And he talked about live work and said that the artists move the rats out and the developers move the artists out. Well, I thought that was a great quote, because it's very often the artists that move into areas, and certainly in London it's been the case, where they'll move into really kind of run-down areas and make it very trendy, and then they're out because they can't afford to stay there anymore, and they have to move to the next area, which makes that part trendy. And then the developers almost now follow them around. Oh, well, that'll become trendy because the artists are all living there. But it's hard now. It's tough in London because it's just the property prices, the rentals, everything. It's really difficult for young artists to find space.
You also do some elegant jewelry pieces. Can you tell us a little about these designs?
I'd never done anything like that. Pangolin wanted to do an exhibition on artist jewelry. So there were artists like Alexander Calder, Picasso, and there was a whole range of artists that had made jewelry, and Damien Hirst made jewelry. And they asked me, would I make some pieces for the exhibition? So I thought, well, okay. I started working in brass and copper, and I bought lots of quite small elements, almost as if you were to scale down or look through a microscope some big sculpture pieces that might then be scaled down to very tiny parts. And I bought soldering iron, everything on a small scale. So it was like a hobby type process with all these tiny little folding machines for bending things and rolling machines for curving things. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll make a few. And so I think I probably made about five or six, which went into the exhibition, and people really liked them, and I think they sold the pieces. And then I liked making them because it was a change from making really big things. So I would sit at a table and work away at these small pieces. So to date, I've probably made about 25, 30 of these pieces. And it's just sort of in fits and starts. If I work for a few days, and then I might not work for months on these things. So probably moving towards, because I haven't really got any of them left, I might make a few more. And it is interesting because each time my sculptures change, on the larger sculptures and on the silkscreen prints, when I go back to make something else, I'll approach it in a fresh way. So some of them were gold, rose gold coated, some of them were nickel coated. Sometimes I would just leave them in the brass and copper. I like that mix of materials. So I think I'll do some more. I've also made a series of very, very tiny sculptures. So they're not jewelry, but they're very, very small sculptures from about 3 inches across to 6 inches across, that sort of scale. And it's a lot of fun making them. And also there's just that flexibility of being able to turn elements over, try one piece with another thing, change it very quickly, not be too precious about it, because if you're working on a big sculpture that's costing a lot of money and you bought all the materials, there's a much more pressure and sort of preciousness about it. It's a nice way to work, as is printmaking, because to be able to make 30 or 40 things in 3 days is fantastic. I love it. And then they go in the boxes in the print store, and then people come to look at them. And then it's a real surprise to me because I go through the prints that I might not have seen for months. So that's about to happen again for the exhibition in Thirsk. We'll be selecting works for there.
And do you have any other exhibitions coming up that you can tell us about?
The one at Deal was actually quite big as an exhibition. The one that I'm putting the two really